Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Rutal. In this episode, we'll be discussing our recent back issue purchases as well as reviewing a classic comic storyline.
All right, the back issues we're going to be talking about in this episode are contained in the Chronicles of Conan, Volume 8, Brothers of the Blade and Other Stories by Dark Horse. And the actual issues, though, were from Conan the Barbarian, numbers, 52 to 59?
59, right, from Marvel.
From the Marvel Conan the Barbarian series. So, cool. All right, what all have you bought since the last time we did a back issue spotlight?
Ooh, what haven't I bought since the last time I did?
Ooh, actually,
I'm going to start with some 50-cent bin finds.
Okay.
And what I did was I actually counted it up, and it's starting to pay off my not buying books and then looking for them in the 50-cent bins. Because these are ones that I chose not to buy about, I don't know, maybe a year ago or so. I just stopped getting, and I picked up what at retail would have been $157.53. I paid $23.50.
Wow.
Which translates to about an 85% discount, so you can't beat that with a stick. So I made note. I got American Dream number 1 through 5. I got that complete miniseries.
I like that. That was fun.
Yeah. The Avengers Classic books, which, you know, when those came out, I looked at them and said, okay, it's a reprint of an Avengers story that I've already got reprints of, and in most cases, the original. And, you know, all I'm paying the $3 for is the 8-page backup story and the new Art Adams cover. Well, an 8-page backup and an Art Adams cover is not worth $3, but it's certainly worth 50 cents to me.
Mm-hmm.
So getting out of the 50-cent bin is good. So I got 1, 2, and 3, and then 10, 11, and 12. So I got 6 of the 12 issues. I'll still have to look around for the other 6. Batman Confidential, I got the entire Wrath storyline, 13, 14, 15, and 16, which I had not previously picked up.
Let me know what you think of that one.
I will indeed. And Captain America The Chosen, I stopped buying that after the first issue. I picked up 3, 4, and 5, so I'll still need to find number 2 and number 6. Listeners may recall that I stopped buying Countdown to Mystery after issue 4, picked up 5, 6, 7, and 8, so I completed that miniseries. Crossing Midnight, I think I only ever bought this Vertigo series out of bins, and I got 17, 18, and 19, which completes the series. It ended at issue 19. DC Special Raven, just the completist in me, caused me to get issues 3, 4, and 5 after I stopped buying that awful pile of stuff at issue 2.
That really shows how much of a completist you are.
Yeah.
Because, man, the art in that was that was painful to read.
Indeed. Virgin Comics, Doc Walloper, Ed Burns book, 1, 2, and 3. There were 5 issues of that that came out, so I'll look around for the other ones. People may also recall that I stopped getting Marvel Comics Presents. I picked up 5, 7, 10, and 11, which leave me a few more to finish that series off, but I have no doubt I'll find them at some point. Metal Men miniseries, 3, 6, 7, and 8. Got a couple more to look for there. Midnighter 9, 10, 11, and 12. I stopped buying that after issue 8. I got the entire miniseries of The Ride, Die Valkyrie. I'm going to say Die Valkyrie as opposed to Die Valkyrie. But I don't know. I'm thinking it's going German, but who knows.
Yeah.
That Spider-Man series with great power that I blanched at the $3.99 cover price. Well, hey, for 50 cents a piece, I got issues 1 and 2.
Yeah.
If I
third of the way there.
5, yeah. 3, 4, and 5, I'll pick those up. The IDW Star Trek Alien Spotlight found the Andorians, Borg, and Vulcans issues. I had previously found Romulans, so I need to find the Orions and the Gorn, and I'll have all of those. And then Wolverine Origins number 23. So again, $157 for about 23.
Nice.
Some other recent stuff, thanks to John Carroll, who had a sale going on at his local comic shop. I got a hold of Hellblazer number 180 to 229 for about $1 an issue. I had a big gap in my Hellblazer, and that plugs a lot of it. And I finally found the last black and white Battle Pope issue that I didn't have, the number one from Funkotron, one of the real early Robert Kirkman books. And in fact, in the back matter of that issue, we find that Robert Kirkman went to school with Tony Moore and met him, you know, as when they were both kids. That's why Tony Moore was doing all the Robert Kirkman stories early on. So that's when he's not leading mass, he's out kicking ass. That's the tagline for that particular thing. Then the old stuff, I have found a Batman number 104, 153, and 260. The 260 plugged a hole, so I now have 244 and up on Batman. Brave and Bold number 52 and 84. That 84 plugged in a hole, and I have now 64 and up on that. Detective 308, 312, Flash 115, 119, 127, 131, Green Lantern 25, 27, and 61. These are all first series, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hulk 118, which completes the series for me.
Wow, congratulations. That's
basically
cool.
Well, after the restart from Tales to Astonish, right? I'm still missing one issue of Tales to Astonish with Hulk in it, and I don't have numbers 1 through 6 of the Hulk from the first run. And then Showcase, I got number 76, which is the first Batlash, and number 79, which is the first appearance of Dolphin. And then I got Superman 168, Lois Lane 95 and 104, Jimmy Olsen 104. Some giant size issues with, you know, like the giant turtle boils.
Oh, right. The classic transformation.
You know, so, just like weird, you know, it's like weird Jimmy Olsen transformation issue. Then I plugged in a hole with Thor number 165. I now have 130 and up of that. Just a couple more issues to go to finish that off. I still have Journey into Mystery that I have to work on, but almost got my Thors complete. And then Wonder Woman 191 and 196, which are a couple of her white jumpsuit and I Ching era of Wonder Woman, which are surprisingly hard to find. You know, I look around for those all the time, and the Wonder Womans in that particular era are just not in long supply at places. And every now and again, I'll find one and I snap it up. But so I've been busy again.
I actually bought a few back issues now that I think about it. I went to the Labor Day sale at Austin Books. And I'm too lazy to go through the long boxes is what it comes down to. So I don't tend to buy a whole lot that way. But I bought issue 27 of Astonishing Tales. I need 25, and I think that finishes off the Deathlok storylines there. I bought 353 and 357 of Batman. I still need 356. I'm just trying to push that a little bit further back, although obviously nowhere near as far back as some of your runs go. And then I got Wonder Woman 318 and 321, which I think gets me to where that series started with the Huntress backups and all the way to the end of that run. So from like, I think 275 forward, which, yeah, not horribly impressive, I'm sure, but still. Just filling in a couple of gaps here and there.
That's around when, was Perez doing Wonder Woman around then?
It was, it was before the reboot.
Garcia Lopez.
It was actually some really cool stuff, but Wonder Woman is one of those that my understanding is to keep the rights to the character, they need to do 4 issues a year of a Wonder Woman comic, not just a comic she's in. And I could be totally wrong on this, so, I mean, you know, don't hold me to it. I'm not a lawyer, I don't work at DC, I've got nothing to do with the rights. But the point is, this is a title that they've been cranking out monthly by and large, you know, for decades now, including a couple of points where perhaps the sales didn't quite warrant it, just so they could hang on to the rights. So that may be why some of these things are a bit harder to find than other comics of the time. So, because, I mean, I've had a hard time finding just like that 318 and 321, right? And that was about a year before that title got canceled for Crisis and rebooted with George Perez. So it's a cool character, but yeah, not always easy to find the back issues for. So five comics for me. Not much, I know.
Get to work.
Oh, I will. Trust me, I will. I've placed an order. I've fallen off the wagon. So next time we do one of these, I'll have a lot more to talk about. So, but I will wait for the comics to actually come. I wait until I have them in my hands first.
Yep, me too. I've got some stuff on the way from my comic shop also, so there'll be more stuff.
I just find it a lot easier to shop at like my comic shop than at a physical store, because all I got to do is click yes, 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 and, you know, versus, you know, rifling through the bins. But I'm lazy that way.
For fill-in issues, certainly. At conventions, or if a store's having a particular sale, I don't mind going through the bins. And I actually found myself being able to go through 50-cent bins and actually find stuff for the first time in about 5 or 6 years. So I'm actually liking not getting everything that comes out on the racks, because I'm able to find, you know, especially the stuff that I'm tending to cut is exactly the kind of stuff my predictions are holding true. And they're like exactly the kind of stuff that's hitting the bins. So
yeah,
I was happy. I'm like looking through, ooh, look at this big stack that I got cheap.
Well, I mean, almost by definition, if somebody like you isn't getting it, it's going to hit the bins.
Yeah. So you want to go on to Conan?
Yeah, let's talk about Conan. I want to tell you what my exposure to Conan has been prior to reading Volume 8 of Chronicles of Conan. And that's two issues of What If.
Okay.
So as you can tell, I'm horribly in-depth in the character. One of them is, I believe it was issue 39 of the original series, What If Thor of Asgard Had Met Conan the Barbarian, which my database tells me is in my collection, but I've got virtually no recollection of. But sure, okay, maybe I probably got it. I have no idea why I would have gotten it. And then the other one was What If 16 of the second run that lasted for like 115 issues or whatever. And that was What If Wolverine Had Lived During the Age of Conan the Barbarian. And I recall reading that one and not being overly impressed with the art. But that's the sum total of my exposure to Conan prior to reading this.
Okay, well, I've had quite a lot of exposure to Conan prior to this. I probably started reading it around issue 25 of the Marvel run and got every issue from there on out, plus all the Savage Sword of Conan. I had gone back and read either reprints or collected the issues up to 25 and Savage Tales and the Dark Horse run. So I'm along. I've read the Robert E. Howard Conan novels. So
now, have you read the actual ones he wrote in his original stuff or the edited versions?
Oh, I'm sure I've read the edited versions. Okay. I mean, I've bought, you know, paperbacks of the Conan books in the 70s, you know, when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I didn't, you know, same thing when I read the Doc Savage novels. I later found out when I got my hands on some of the actual original pulps that they were pretty heavily edited by the time they hit the Bantam paperbacks. They took a lot of really racist stuff out of the Doc Savage ones.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to do that, though, because the standards change over time.
Yeah. I mean, just stuff that was common, you know, like 1930 or 35 or whenever those things came out, just like common vernacular and things that they would say in there is like, whoa, you know, don't want to have that stuff in there. And then just other stuff that kind of cleaned up a little bit, tightened it up. But, you know, back to Conan, you know, I'm sure it was all edited kind of stuff that I read, but, you know, I've read the prose stuff as well. And when somebody on the forums, and it was ENG on the forums, he suggested we talk about Conan on a back issue spotlight on the back issue thread. He actually started reading Conan at around the issues right after Roy Thomas finished writing the series when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have my fondest memories of Roy Thomas writing Conan. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to give you your first exposure to Conan, let's kind of pull back into one of my more favored runs, which is really the Elite stories that started in Conan number 58 with Queen of the Black Coast. And, you know, just 58 and 59 were in this volume. So if we were going to pick some run of issues that were easily grabbable in a trade paperback, you know, that's the one I chose to dive you in on. That way you got the Brothers of the Blade stories as well, where Conan was wandering around with the with Murillo and his what do they call themselves? The Crimson Company.
Yeah, the Crimson Company.
Mercenaries.
That was actually the part of the trade I enjoyed the most. I enjoyed that more than the stories back at the end with Baylit. I mean, the stories with Baylit were not bad, but I found some of the supporting characters in the Crimson Company and stuff just funner to read. So I thought this was a good pick for me to start on. A part of it is John Buscema, I mean, amazing artist. So he you know, is always it's fun to read, you know, his art and stuff. It's great stuff. And, of course, Roy Thomas. I mean, I'm a huge Roy Thomas fan. Some of the stuff that got me hooked on comics was the Roy Thomas run on All-Star Squadron, on Infinity Inc. I mean, really, all of his Earth 2 stuff, which is part of why I really love the whole concept of the multiverse. So I felt this was a very good pick for me, whether it be for anyone else, I don't know, to kind of properly introduce me to the character. So I thought that was a good choice.
And just classic art. I mean, it's all Buscema in this, except that one fill-in issue with Mike Ploog art. Now, I kind of like Mike Ploog. It is very different than Buscema, so you can really tell when that issue kind of comes along. It's a real change of pace when you're reading it, but not bad. But then just even the opening splash on that first page of Queen of the Black Coast, I love that image where Conan's riding the horse.
Yeah,
you know, down to the wharves where he catches the ships. Mm-hmm. This is classic stuff, you know.
Well, I mean, it's good solid art, you know, throughout, as you would expect. And, you know, it's good action adventure story throughout. It's one of those where I was a little concerned that it's like, okay, the guy's a barbarian, he's got a sword, you know, how much can they really do with the character? Well, it turns out quite a bit. And quite a bit of very interesting stuff. So, you know, I really didn't have much in the way of expectations going into this, but it certainly met what I expected in terms of the level of action and adventure, and really exceeded them in terms of the characterization, both for Conan and for a lot of the other characters.
Yeah, so, I mean, we can do like a quick recap without having any spoilers, per se, at the beginning. I mean, basically what we've got here is the first 52 through 57, right?
Yeah.
So the first six issues are essentially Conan makes it to this city, and he meets up with the guy he'd known in the past and joins his mercenary company. And there are some variety of adventures that happen while Conan is a mercenary member of the Crimson Company, and he falls in with a young girl who's kind of an acrobat and becomes his squire of sorts named Tara. And there's Murillo as the captain of the Crimson Company, who Conan had known, and some other various supporting characters. And then ultimately they end up making it to Argos and the ocean after they part ways with the Crimson Company. And Conan parts ways with Tara and makes it onto a ship, and he meets Baylit and her pirates. And through a series of happenings, he ends up basically first mate on Baylit's pirate crew. And this pretty much sets them up for one of the longest runs of continuity in Conan comics that I can think of, because basically from issue 58 through issue 100, he is sailing with Baylit and having adventures with Baylit and her company. So, you know, 42 issues of continuity there is a long time. It's, three and a half years.
Yeah, 3.5 years. Really. That's insane. I mean, particularly with the amount of story they put in each of these issues. I mean, these days, 3.5 years, 42 issues, whatever. I mean, that's what, 6-7 storylines, if that. Whereas, back in this manner of storytelling, that's, 42 plus probably.
Right. Now, this was 1975, so I was 13. And, Baylitz running around in a glorified bikini most of the times. And she's, drawn by John Buscema. She's beautiful. Maybe that's why I have these really fond memories of these stories. I'm 13 and it's like, woo, It's probably why I like Red Sonja too. But, it's just this really hit a sweet spot with me. And I think with a lot of adolescent boys, because these were some very strong selling, just according to Roy Thomas in the editorial that he has, the afterword of this book. He was saying that Conan was one of the strongest selling books for Marvel for this period of time. And I can believe it. I mean, I read it. A lot of guys I knew read Conan, and people who didn't read the superhero stuff, you still read Conan.
Yeah, so. I can totally believe it was a strong seller for Marvel.
But still good stories. I had not read these stories since 1975, or so when they came out. And I came in, picked this trade up. I had been buying the trades with the intent of picking them off the shelf and rereading them, and had not gotten around to rereading them. And I read these stories for the first time in, 35 years or so, 30 years at least. And they held up to me. I think they still were good, solid stories. So if you like sword and sorcery and you like the adventure and that kind of genre, these are really good books to pick up. Now, we're trying a new thing here where we're going to talk a little bit generally about the storyline before we get into spoilers. So we're kind of in the general part of the episode right now, and then we'll transition into a little more in-depth look at the different issues.
Well, and the reason we're doing that is one of our listeners, Randy, had emailed because he'd read on the forum how we're thinking about doing a lot more current stuff. And he was saying that with current stuff, spoilers are more of an issue. And it's like, he's right. And he was asking for kind of a spoiler-free and then a spoiler-filled section, to where if you haven't read it, you could just kind of stop when we get to the spoiler part. And, if you've been interested by what we were saying and enticed to read it, you have that chance to go read it and then listen to the rest of the episode. And then I got to thinking, well, I mean, this Conan stuff's been around for, 30 years, and it was new to me. So, I mean, we should be, the idea of the spoiler-free and the spoiler-filled makes sense for the older stuff, too, in my opinion. So we're trying it out here. Let us know what you think of the idea.
Yeah. So any more general comments? I mean, for me, this is a big thumbs up for anybody who likes the fantasy type of stuff. And it's not high fantasy. You're not going to find elves and, things like that running around. But there are big, giant monsters, and there's some magic. It's light sword and sorcery. It's not like the high fantasy kind of sword and sorcery. There's a little bit of magic and a little bit of monsters in it, but not an overwhelming amount.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also totally agree that the stories hold up to today's standards. I think they're a bit wordier than most comics today, but that's only because I think most comics today are very light on captions and dialogue. And that's, again, just a difference of, 30 years later in storytelling. But this read at a fairly good clip for me. It took me about an hour and a half-ish, a little under probably. And this is, 9 issues? 8 issues? So there's definite depth to it. I didn't feel like it was slow reading. I didn't feel like I was just flying through it too fast either. It was a good, comfortable pace. So yeah, it totally holds up to my expectations for modern comics. So I would agree that this is one that, if this sort of a genre interests you, it's worth checking out. Even if the genre is not something you're horribly interested in, if you're at least open to trying it out and you're fans of either John Buscema or Roy Thomas, it's worth checking out on those grounds too. That's really where I came at it from.
Yeah, and you you made an interesting observation before we started recording about what you thought of. I had it there and then I lost it. What you thought of just the general type of story that you're getting here out of Conan. And now I'm rambling because I don't remember the exact comment that you made.
Must not have been that interesting.
Wasn't that interesting? I hate it when that happens. You get like the thought in your head and then you like start saying it and then you lose it. Anyway.
Happens to me all the time. I'm used to it. So.
Well, we can go into spoilers at this point. Anyone who does not want to hear an in-depth discussion of the individual stories in this particular trade can excuse themselves now. Otherwise, we'll start talking about the individual issues.
Sounds good to me.
So the first issue here, number 52, it's Roy Thomas, and then the artists are John Buscema and Tom Palmer. Tom Palmer, also as an inker, has been very well known for doing a beautiful job on inking Gene Colan. Very strong, very competent art in these issues. You know, the detail on the first page here in the crowd scene, I mean, some of the stuff way in the background is, you know, not, you know, that well defined. But I mean, there's just a lot of stuff going on here. You got, you know, a little kid playing with the dog. You got, you know, a little kid running along. You got that bear, you know, that they've got in the festival that they're doing something with, and people doing deals and booths, and Conan's coming in. And he comes into the town, and he has just come off another series of adventures that, you know, obviously if you read Volume 7 of this Dark Horse thing, you could learn more about. But he's, like anything, the story of Conan is, you know, he started out as a barbarian. He's up in Samaria, and he's been slowly kind of working his way south as he gets older and older. And he's very young in the first couple of volumes of this series, and you know, when he started out in the Marvel Comics series, and he's been getting a little older and a little more seasoned, and he's probably in his, you know, I would say mid to late 20s as this one starts here, and he's really looking for some kind of employment, some way to make money. And you know, he's of course looking for a job as a mercenary, because you know, that's what he does. You know, he's a fighter. So he goes into the town. He starts asking around. Hears that the Crimson Company's in town looking for new recruits. And then a bull breaks free and starts rampaging through the marketplace. And an acrobat comes out and does some acrobatic moves, distracting the bull. And then Conan just grabs the bull, grabs his arms around its neck, and breaks its neck. And, you know, makes some kind of statement like, I broke a bull's neck on the day I became a man, and by the gods, I'll lay down and die the day I can't do it again. And, you know, this just gives you a good introduction, John, especially when you're not reading much. I mean, that's pretty much Conan in a nutshell, you know.
Well, I thought this was an excellent opening action sequence, and one that I particularly enjoyed on a number of different levels. One is it really, you know, establishes Conan as he's this big, strong guy. He is a fighter, and you know, in this case, literally will take the bull by the horns. But the other thing I enjoyed about this was the introduction of, you know, the character that goes on to become his squire. You know, I've always loved acrobatic characters. It's a good look for this character in terms of the outfit and stuff. A good introduction for, you know, slowing down the bull long enough for Conan to get over there. But what I really enjoyed and just noticed is if you look on page 8 of the trade, when we first see the bull running wild, look at the panel above it. In the background is the acrobat. It's not one of those where suddenly, you know, on the next page, out of nowhere comes this acrobat. If you're looking for it, they've established it in the backgrounds. And that, to me, is also one of the things that really differentiates kind of the depth of these stories compared to a lot of what we get today, where you've got no backgrounds, you've got no details, and you've got no grounding or world that these stories take place in. With these, you know, certainly not in every panel does the background really matter, but it's there, and there's stuff going on back there. And there are, to be perfectly honest, too, there are a couple of panels on page 9 where there are no backgrounds whatsoever. But they didn't need to be, because that's not what the action in that panel was about. So I thought this was just a very well done action sequence that told me a lot about, again, the depth of the storytelling, both a strong introduction for the acrobat Tara, and a good opening set piece for Conan himself. So this is part of what started the trade-off on a good foot for me, is I enjoyed all of this a lot.
Yeah, and then, you know, we get the same thing. You know, it's like Tara is, you know, he meets Murillo with the Crimson Company, and then there's some stuff that happens where the guys start manhandling Tara, and, you know, Conan, you know, she actually sticks up for herself, right? And just, it gives you a good establishment that Conan reaches in and he stops a guy from, you know, taking a sword to her, but then she pretty much takes care of the other guy herself. So she's not kind of shy, retiring little person, and it really sets the scene for how this character is going to go. And, you know, then we move into a really nice sequence here on page 14, you know, a little montage where Murillo's giving Conan some fencing lessons, because Conan was kind of a hack slash guy with the sword, and he's teaching him a little bit more technique. Gives Conan some armor because Conan was bare-chested mostly before, and he gets this mail shirt that he uses for a while and a nice cape, gives him a little superhero-y kind of look, but not, you know, not ridiculous, but I mean, it gives him a nice look and that helmet.
Now, the question I have at this point is, prior to this, was he basically going around in the look he had in the previous pages?
Yeah. So this pretty much that loincloth, that fur kind of loincloth thing with the belt and the sword, and that's pretty much it.
Okay. So I imagine this was a bit of a transition issue from what had gone before.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out how much of a smooth storyline, you know, is it like at one point in the Superman stuff, it was literally a never-ending battle. There wasn't kind of a the end, we start a new chapter in the ongoing storyline with the next issue. Whereas in here, I'm getting a feeling like this is very much the start, a good jumping-on point is what it comes down to.
Yeah. They have definite transitions as you read through Conan, where he goes from point to point in his life, you know, when he goes from being, you know, young to a little older to a little, and it's just each one transitions. And ultimately, and they started up a new series called King Conan, where he actually, you know, that's part of the Conan legend. At one point, he actually overthrows a corrupt king and he becomes king of Aquilonia. That whole thing goes on its way. He marries, he has a son. There's a whole series of stories where he has a son too. You know, and there's lots of change that happens with Conan. He's not this static character, which I hadn't really thought of it before, but you know, there's you know, with a lot of superhero characters, they don't mess with the status quo that much over time. I mean, there's some little ones, you know, Spider-Man will go from being a high school student to being a college student to, you know, being married to
not being, you know, married,
having a clone to not having a clone to, you know, his marriage never existed because there was magic involved, you know, whatever, you know, but
Conan, that's set
significant life changes. You know, he ages. You know, there's definite age difference. If you look at this Conan versus the Conan that was in issues, you know, 1 through 10 of the series, you can tell that he's an older, more experienced character. And again, as you move into later Conan stories, you can, in the Marvel run, you can see that difference as well, progressing as he becomes, you know, more and more experienced. And just, you know, the basic honor of the character and his code is also pretty apparent as you're reading this issue.
Yeah, and that was an aspect of the character I really enjoyed is, you know, he's got his own sense of what's right and what's wrong, what's acceptable, what's not, and he follows that. Now, it doesn't always match what everyone else around him thinks, which is part of what's fun, but he's an honorable man in his own way. So I found that fun.
So it's this story, and we're only halfway into the story. You know, they move out of town. They're moving, they're moving on to this other town where there's some work for the Crimson Company in a mercenary capacity. There's some campfire tales of an old altar with the scorpion god, and there's a little bit of a weird flashback scene here. They try to tie it into King Kull of Volusia and I think, you know, Marvel at the time, Kull was another Robert E. Howard character, King Kull. He was Kull, and then he became King Kull. So same kind of thing where Howard, I think, liked having his characters age and, you know, take on, you know, royalty to some extent. You know, both Conan and Kull did that. And so Marvel, I think, tried to make some kind of relationship between Kull and Conan, although I'm not convinced that there was ever any direct correlation between the two like this in the Robert E. Howard stories. But anyway, I think Roy Thomas might have even mentioned something similar to that in the afterword.
I think he did, and I think he mentioned that he thought it was a cool idea, but it was not something that has really been done in the books, and that Robert E. Howard kind of kept the two properties separate, even though there's definite, you know, some similarities there.
Yeah. So they go along, they find this ruins, there's the old scorpion there, and they muscle it aside to get into the hidden chamber. It comes to life and wreaks some havoc, kills a bunch of people, and of course Conan stops it. And they go down into the tomb, and there's this ring of black shadow, and they're told don't touch this. They leave a couple of guys to guard it, and what do you think? One of these guys touches it. And this is going to play through, you know, the next several issues as kind of a side story until it merges back in. But basically, it's called the Ring of Shadows. This guy touches it, and this shadow envelops him. And then the shadow monster envelops the next guy and gets a little larger. So this is something that is going to play into the story as we go along. And that puts us into the next issue. Do you want to switch off and do the summary of the next one?
Sure. Now, by this point, they've left the two guys at the one place in that last issue, and they're heading off to go meet up with, I think, the person who has hired them. So, of course, they get to that city, that castle, whatever, and, of course, the first thing that happens is archers attack them. Nice opening splash page kind of setting that up, and they're, you know, Conan's doing the Crom's devil, you know, the dogs are firing upon us type thing. And, you know, there was something about the way the dialogue was written here. I picture him having, like, the 80s cartoon Saturday morning voice with the deep voice, you know, the powerful voice and stuff.
Like Space Ghost or something?
Yeah, kind of like a Space Ghost. You know what I mean? It's one of those classic voice actor type things. It just reeked of that. And again, start with a good opening action sequence where, you know, they've got to take out the guys who are trying to shoot them. Only to be telling him, you know, hey, we're the guys you hired to protect your city. So they meet under a flag of truce. This is where one of these things where we you know, get reminded Conan is indeed a barbarian. This whole truce thing, this whole civilization thing, not totally comfortable with it, but it had some fun stuff. And then they wind up getting into the city, but only Conan, Tara, and Murillo. They leave the army out there. They're not their army, but, you know, there are other guys outside. And, of course, kind of, you know, address that of, you know, do you really want to bring in, you know, a bunch of guys into this so they can be, you know, tempted to loot it and whatnot? They meet with the king, who's basically saying, you know, hey, here's what I'm hiring you to do. Because, of course, all the details are kind of vague on this. Because so far Conan's been just, you know, going with whatever Murillo says because he's an old friend, whatever, and is kind of curious, you know, what exactly is the plan? Well, and the plan was really, I thought, both clever and insanely convoluted, because this is the city or whatever of Roanoke. And there are two other cities, Carnolia, I'm going to get these names wrong, I'm horrible at this, and Pergona. And basically, the other two cities are in the process of getting an alliance together through an arranged marriage. This king's saying, I don't want that. You know, our feud with the one side is really bad, but if we were allied with the Pergona, you know, we'd be fine. So what I want you to do, guys, is go kidnap the daughter of Pergona and basically, you know, set up the other city for the Fall Guy and this whole, you know, bizarre machination to do this. And it's like, okay, we're getting some interesting political intrigue here. I hadn't really expected that, but that was fun. We then get introduced to the Brothers of the Blade, And these are guys who've had body parts replaced by metal weapons. One guy has this huge axe in place of one of his hands. One guy has this bizarre clawfoot blade thing. And the other guy has a steel skull. And in the afterword, Roy Thomas kind of equated them to... which group of villains was that? It wasn't the Wrecking Crew, was it?
It was the Wrecking Crew.
Okay.
It was the Wrecking Crew.
Right. Pile Driver, I'm blanking.
Bulldozer, yeah. Wrecker, and Thunderball.
Thunderball, right. Which, you know, in the interesting parallel, because I hadn't really caught on to that until the afterword. We get reminded about the Ring of the Black Shadow, which, you know, the guys touched last time, even though they were told not to. And then Merlo, Conan, and company, you know, go on their way to fulfill their mission. And they're trying, you know, Conan's, you know, it's like, hey, I got this idea that may save us some trouble. And we then cut to the camp where the Brothers of the Blade are, and they're a gang of other miscreants or what have you, as they get approached by a beggar and a child, which of course is going to be Conan and Tara. They make a quick attack against Conan. Conan does nothing because it's like, hey, not yet time. We get to meet the princess who's, you know, the victim of all of this subterfuge and machinations and stuff. And basically the brothers say, hey, you know, you're property here. You don't have any say in the matter. Shut the hell up and stay out of the way. Things basically start to go south there because the other Brothers of the Blade decide, you know, hey, we don't really need these beggars. Let's just kill them. So they take a swipe at Tara. Tara says, nothing doing. Starts to fight back. And we again see, you know, what a skilled acrobat she is and a pretty talented fighter because she, you know, knocks one of the guys onto his back. At which point, you know, Conan says, it's like, okay, you know, we're fighting now. Which, you know, I don't think Conan was upset with. So we get this really good action sequence with those two going after the three Brothers of the Blade. And that goes for a couple of pages. And between some of the dialogue and particularly some of the captions, it's not just a mindless fight. We actually, you know, get a feeling for, you know, what's Conan thinking, you know, what's at stake here, and you know, what's the strategy going on.
I like about these old books, which is somewhat different than the newer ones that kind of like more let the art just tell the whole story. I mean, I like the description, you know, for a second, the two giants lock in close combat, the raw power of each braced against that of the other, unmoving as one well-carved statue carved by the nimble-fingered Kothians, twin beings of dead marvel, yet seemingly ready to come alive at any moment. As indeed they do, you know?
It's yeah. Like,
it's just, you can see in the way Buscema draws this, you know, it's just, and you got guys in the background watching and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just, I like the description. It's a style of comic and you just don't see it that much anymore, but it's enjoyable to me to read.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, on these couple of pages, you could take either just the art or just the captions and dialogue, and still follow the story fine. And they're both so much in sync that with them both, it gives you an extra level of story or whatnot. And that's something that I feel is very much missing in a lot of modern comics. I mean, it makes for a wordier story, but again, these are words that are adding depth, adding texture to the story. And not, hey, these two guys are still fighting, type, you know, redundant captions. So they wind up defeating all three guys, and by defeating, I mean killing. At which point, you know, the Crimson Company finally arrives to come save the day. And Merlo's, I think, a little upset that not only has he missed the fight, but Conan's killed all three of them because he could have actually, you know, ransomed them off and made some money that way. But again, you know, Conan, barbarian, doesn't think that way.
Like, ransom these guys, you know, escape. And, you know, that's always what, you know, superheroes don't kill. And this is, you know, slightly different. You bring up a good point because this is a rough and tumble time. And it's kind of like a Western where people are getting shot, except some of those Marvel Westerns where they just like shoot the guns out of each other's hands and stuff. I mean, Conan is very pragmatic. And it's like, if you kill this guy, he is not going to escape to come back and come after you again another day. You know, it's like, you got a problem. Let's deal with the problem and make sure it does not reoccur. And, well, you know, that's something to be said for that.
And they kind of touch on that at the beginning or earlier in the fight scene on page 36 of the trade here. where when Tara kills one of these guys, the captions are basically, you know, hard as it may be to believe, in this harsh Harbarian age, Tara, at the ripe old age of 17, has never killed a man before. Thus she stands there a moment, suddenly paralyzed at the realization of what she's done. You know, and it's one of those things that, again, that's texturing the story. It's letting you know at 17, she's not young in this age and this time period. That's an old person. It was expected she would have killed by now, and it's an accepted part of life then. So, I mean, this is just some great fun stuff. And really, part of what I enjoyed of a lot of these earlier issues was the Tara character. You know, particularly how, you know, the princess is you know, Tara's told to look after her, and the princess is like, ah, nah, she hadn't bathed, you know, nothing going on. So, you know, Tara picks up a bucket of water and splashes her with it and stuff. She doesn't take any of this stuff.
Yeah.
She's a definite spitfire and a fun character. And then we get the epilogue at the end, which goes to the party, which has been sent to go fetch that ring, only to find out that shadow creature's gotten a bit bigger, a bit nastier, and only one of the people out of that party manages to escape to let Conan and Murillo know that, hey, things didn't go too well there.
Yeah, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and gobbling up these guys and their horses, and it's anything alive. The shadow is consuming, and it is getting bigger. That brings us into the next issue. We're back at the town of Renoko. This issue is the Oracle of Ophir, and the princess is there, and she is demanding to Captain Murillo that she be brought back to her father's house in Pergona, and they're having none of that. They bring her up to I don't know if he's a king or, you know, whatever the head guy is of this town. And he makes it pretty clear that we're going to have a treaty of peace. And to do that, I'm going to marry you off to my son. And she doesn't want to have any of that. She gives him a good kick. And there's some frivolity that goes on with that. And ultimately, the son, who is not a big fan of Conan, because he's the one who actually ordered the archers to fire on them when they originally first came upon the town, and Conan pretty much knocked him down for doing that. And so he suggests, well, you know, we need to contact the Oracle in order to figure out what we should do. So they send Conan off to contact the Oracle. And he, of course, brings Tara, and he brings Yusuf, who is a new character who is introduced. He is the one guy who rode away surviving the Shadow Beast at the very end of the last issue. So Tara and Yusuf go with Conan. They go up to where the Oracle's cave is. Now, when they get there, there's this big guy who is the Mustafo, the high priest of the Oracle of Ophir. And he's like, well, anyone who wants to come through here and talk to the Oracle needs to pay the price. And the price is, Conan asks, well, your right arm sheared off at the elbow. And so you get the feeling that the king's son knew that that was the price, and he has like kind of a thing against Conan. That's why he sent Conan off to here, because he figured Conan was either going to get his arm cut off or he's going to fight this big guy and get killed. Well, you know, Conan fights the big guy, and what do you think happens? He's a star. He wins. He takes out this guy, and he says, oh, you've got a nice sword. You have no longer have any need for that ornate-handled sword. I will take it to make up for the nicks you put in mine during our fight. So he takes it, crawls in to see the Oracle. The Oracle, as oracles often do in these stories, has a bunch of weird cryptic stuff to say that, you know, is left open for interpretation. Kind of a skeleton face, very strange. There's this little misshapen dude who's been lurking around in the shadows for a lot of pages. We get the kind of feeling that they don't come right out and say it. They imply it very strongly that it's this little weird dude is kind of like maybe throwing his voice into this oracle.
Yeah.
Do you get that impression also?
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of think, you know, there's some mystic stuff going on, but, you know, I get the feeling that this guy is kind of pulling the strings. But then the magic stuff happens, because when Conan tries to leave, he finds out that there's some kind of an invisible barrier. And as it turns out, if you kill that high priest guardian, you become the new guardian. Now, he pushes and pushes and pushes, and of course, Conan is the mightiest warrior of a heroic age, and the acceptance of defeat is not in him. So he actually breaks through this unbreakable barrier. But what happened was when he broke through it, a doppelganger of himself was left behind that's got kind of a crazed demonic cast to it. And Conan starts fighting this doppelganger of himself, and he's starting to realize that he cannot beat this doppelganger. So he gets the idea to give the sword back to the priest, and he's keying off of a clue that was given to him by one of the riddles or, you know, cryptic things the oracle said. And he gives the sword back. It brings the high priest back to life. The high priest is able to defeat the Conan doppelganger. And then it comes after Conan, but he is shrewdly moved outside the invisible barrier, so he cannot come after him all the way. And they have their answer, and they ride off back towards the town to give the words of the oracle to the Merlot and the king. So that puts us into the next issue.
And that next issue is A Shadow on the Land. And, of course, we start with them still riding off back to that town. We've got Conan, Tara, and Yusef, whose sole characterization at this point, I think, is his name. Haven't really seen a lot out of him yet. We get a little bit of talking as they head back. Tara, of course, showing off her brilliance and knowledge of the world and how it's, you know, Earth is a round ball and stuff. But, of course, you know, not a very popular concept back then.
Well, she was insistent that it was flat.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, she didn't have any truck with these scholars who say the Earth is a round ball. That's ridiculous.
That's right.
Crazy talk.
Because she knows how things are, and she was right back then. So they're heading off, and at this point, wasn't she also giving Yusef a hard time for running with the shadow thing at first? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's giving him all kinds of grief of being a coward and stuff. So, of course, they come out of the forest. What do they see? The big shadow creature. They're kind of like, oh, crap, that's not good. So what do? They run. Because, I mean, this thing at this point is like two or three times the size of a house. It's picking up horses and people and just kind of, you know, absorbing them and stuff. So they realize that leaving probably a good idea. So they head back to the city. Of course, they've got to, you know, pound open the gate because, you know, they leave it shut, you know. The king is still yelling at the princess who's refusing to marry the son because, I mean, she's no idiot. Conan barges in and basically says, you know, we've got this little problem and, you know, we got to do something about it. And Conan's like, ooh, wait, I think I have an idea. I got to go leave the city. And Marilla's like, you know, no, you got to stay here and protect the town. That's what we're here for. So, you know, I'll come back, and, you know, winds up taking Murillo's horse, which I presume is the best of the horses they have there.
One would assume.
Yeah. So he heads out and encounters the shadow beast thing again, but it decides not to pursue Conan, which allows Conan to go back to the ruins from a few issues back. And, of course, it's night. He sees the crystal scorpion that he'd fought before. Now, he'd defeated it before by, you know, plunging his sword into it and killing it. And the clue from the oracle was, you know, that which was removed needs to be restored or something more cryptic than that. So he takes his sword and plunges it back into the scorpion creature, which it then seems to absorb and then takes off, crawling away. And we cut back to the city. They're gathering all the livestock and whatnot and sending it on ahead to be eaten by the all-hungry shadow because I guess they don't really need horses, and they're starting to run out of animals elsewhere to be found, too, which I got to imagine is going to hurt the local economy some. By this point, the thing is getting almost as tall as the castle wall. They're trying to figure out what to do. The son grabs the princess and says, hey, I'm out of here. Let's take off. Because, of course, he is a coward. By this point, the shadow thing is absorbed enough. It's able to reach over the top of the wall, start absorbing some more people. They shoot the fire arrows at it. Of course, it's a shadow. The fire goes straight through it. Not very effective. And they're like, ooh, that's not good. Now, by this point, they realize that the scorpion creature has come. It starts to attack the shadow thing. So as that battle is about to start, we cut to the king's son having, you know, kidnapped the princess, and their horses stumble, and basically they come across Conan, and Conan and the king's son fight. And gee, guess who wins? Conan has a real habit of doing that, too. He then takes the princess, heads off to the city again. We then get the fight scene between the scorpion and the shadow creature. That goes for about a page, and it's somehow able to absorb or shrink the shadow thing back down into the ring. And this time they make very sure to tell people, do not touch the ring. And this time people listen. And Conan gives Tara a hard time for, you know, how did she do? And was she as, you know, as cowardice as Yusef? And she's realizing that he wasn't a coward, he did the right thing. And that he had stood by her that whole time, so she's now attracted to Yusef, and all is right in the world at that point. Up until the point where the armies of Pergona and Carnola arrive to fight, and the princess basically marches out and says, no, there's not going to be a fight over me today, and basically, you know, prevents the war. And she's going to go back to Pergona and basically decide who she's going to marry, if anyone. And then, basically, they've taken care of the ring, and Conan and Tara decide to head off, because, of course, he's heading for the ocean, whatever. They head out, and Murillo's like, Yusef, what are you doing here? Go after her! So, it's like, does she want me to? It's like, of course she does. So, he hops on a horse, goes after him, so those three head out. And that pretty much, you know, finishes that opening, the whole Brothers of the Blade and the Shadow Demon, you know, arc right there.
Okay, then we have an interstitial issue here where they're basically on their way to... This is kind of like a... Almost like a adventure that happens on the way. They're on their way to Argos, which is the seacoast city, and they pass by this mysterious city in the mist. And we're going to go through this one pretty quick. You know, basically, it's like... There's this city in the mist, and it's kind of mysterious. The horses don't want to cross over the bridge into the strange city, so they walk in. There's just lots of people who are kind of like maybe in a sleepwalky kind of state. There's a beautiful woman up in a tower. There's a bat creature that flies down and grabs her. Conan, Tara, and Yusef, of course, go to save her. They go in the tower. There's, of course, you know, big surprise, two different ways to go. So Conan takes one way, Tara and Yusef take the other. Get up. Tara and Yusef find this weird misshapen dude named Mad Jack, and he's chained up in a room. The city's kind of a living entity that Mad Jack had created, you know, with some spell, because he's all misshapen and weird, and people teased him. So they talk him into not, you know, keeping them captive in the city like everybody else. Everything goes to heck, and Conan's fighting the bat creature. The bat creature dissolves, and the whole city starts crumbling. They all flee back over the bridge, and the city vanishes into the mist. And, well, let's get back on the road and make it out to Argos. So, I mean, it was an entertaining story, but it wasn't really, it was kind of like a filler in the action. Kind of a standalone story that you could read.
Yeah, or if you missed it, you didn't really lose anything.
Right.
Now, the one thing I will say is Pablo Marcos was the embellisher here, and I think the art wasn't quite as good as we'd seen in some of the previous issues when Tom Palmer and one or two of the other people were doing the embellishing. Yeah. So it was a decent issue, but again, it was very literally filler. A good filler, but you know. So that takes us to the incident in Argos. And we start the thing with them still on horseback, getting up to the edge of the city, getting into the city. And they usually do a pretty good job starting these things with a good full-page splash on the title page, setting the scene and the mood. And they get into the city, and basically you know, start pushing people around left, right, and center. I mean, you know, Conan gets into a fight with, I guess, is he a street vendor or somebody? He's just, actually, I think he's just a bum. Then a couple of the captain of the King's Guard come by, and they're pushing people around, including Tara. Conan doesn't take well to that, so he starts throwing them around. And they're like, ah, this guy is bigger than us. Let's you know, bail. So they decide that, okay, we've stirred up some trouble. People are going to be looking for us. Let's go disguise ourselves. So they basically head into a tailor, get Tara a dress, because, I mean, they're never going to recognize her in a dress or whatever, because she's in this almost a court jester type thing for her acrobat outfit. And we actually get some dialogue from Yusef, who's actually, you know, starting to become a bit of an actual character now. They head over to, actually, they're doing that. Conan decides to go get some armor. He's doing that, trying to, you know, thinking about a couple of things. He gets knocked from behind, taken captive. He realizes, oh, wait, you know, these guys are talking about money. Maybe I can pick some up where they're going to cash in on me. It turns out he's being essentially sold into slavery to work on a boat, which, of course, he's not too fond of. So as he's, you know, being taken over there, he breaks free and, you know, fights them. A couple of people get killed. He gets clawed in the face. He runs off. Hides in the murky waters for a little bit, gets rescued, not rescued, he comes out, and this old lady, you know, helps him out to, you know, clean his wounds, whatever, and she's a sorceress type, so she shows him, you know, images from the future, which, you know, presumably is Roy Thomas, you know, foreshadowing the whole next story arc. Or the next, you know, I think maybe 40 issues plus, and maybe even the King Conan stuff.
Well, it is more than that, right? Because you see him on the boat there, which is, you know, somewhat of that. But the King Conan stuff, the Conan nailed to a tree, that's another whole story that they did in Savage Sword of Conan. So just lots of different images from other Robert E. Howard stories.
Well, and this is where it benefits them to have a character that's got a full life history, that they know kind of the parameters they're working in, you know, because they can do this kind of looking forward thing, which is kind of cool. He meets, one of the things he sees is in the present, and that's Tara and Yusef basically running afoul again of the local guardsmen, and Tara just, again, starts a fight. Yusef kills somebody. They have to go run. Conan's like, oh no, I've got to go help them, because of course he's an honorable man. What the lady tries to point out to him is they've already left the tavern that they were in. Conan didn't quite pick up on that, heads to the tavern. People recognize him of, hey, he's the guy who fought the captain this morning. He gets put up in chains and then taken to court the next morning. And this was a fair court. They actually asked him what he thought, and he's like, well, you know, I did the right thing. And they're like, we're going to have to throw you into contempt because we don't agree. So he, of course, breaks out, kills a couple of more guards, pretty much hacks the judge right in half, and realizes he's really kind of overstepped the bounds. He really ought to head out of town. As he's heading out, he apparently comes fairly close to bumping into Tara and Yusef. But, you know, Conan's kind of, you know, more worried about getting the hell out of town. They're trying to stay undercover because they're, of course, being hunted. And that's their exit from the series, or at least this part of the run.
I don't recall if they ever were seen again. I'm going to guess not.
And, I mean, this gets us into the Queen of the Black Coast storyline, which is fine and good, but while this was a great, you know, fun story, and we got a lot about, you know, kind of how Conan thinks, also some in the next issue with that, the way those two characters got essentially thrown out of the story kind of took me back a little, because Tara in particular was one that I had found to be an interesting character and kind of an entry character into the series. Because she was introduced as I was coming into the thing, therefore I was able to follow her story along, whereas Conan's was already in the middle, And then, boom, she's out of there. Oh, I was
to the bin with her.
Yeah. I was interested enough in Conan at this to follow through, but if this was something that I was reading on a monthly basis and was on the fence on, that might have been enough to kind of kick me off the book. So that's where I felt that this was another kind of a breaking point in the run where we're moving on to the next chapter in Conan's life. And that's fine. That's good. I have no problems with that. But it does come at a little bit of a cost, and that being some characters I enjoyed.
Well, and the reason for that, of course, is that that's the way that the story was written by Robert E. Howard. And
details.
A little bit, you know, it's like, you know, really the whole run-up here was getting Conan to Argos so that he could be running from the law, board this ship out into the ocean, and subsequently meet Baelit. So, I mean, they created and introduced these characters, which actually, you know, working backwards, Roy Thomas, rather, made Tara and Yusuf fill in these slots. And I want to read something here, basically, because starting out in Queen of the Black Coast, it picks up where the last one left off. Conan is charging towards the wharves on his horse. This is on page 116 of the trade. It would be on page 1 of issue 58. And, you know, you didn't comment too much about Mike Ploog's art on the previous issue. But, I mean, Ploog has a very distinctive style, and it is very different than Buscema. So I can see how that was kind of a break in the story. And my favorite page of this whole trade is this page 116 here with Conan galloping on the horse. And when he gets on the ship, he's recounting how he came to be on the ship, which is basically a retelling of the events that happened in the last issue. And the reason that this happens is that the way in the Queen of the Black Coast, Robert E. Howard wrote the story was as such. Conan is telling Captain Tito how he got there. And Conan says, "Well, last night in the tavern, a captain of the king's guard offered violence to the sweetheart of a young soldier who naturally ran him through." Now, this is where they took this piece of the story and they made the young soldier and his sweetheart, Yusuf and Tara, to tie that part of the story together. You know, the Yusuf and Tara thing didn't really exist in Robert E. Howard's story. Okay, but it seems there's some cursed law against killing guardsmen, and the boy and his girl fled away. It was bruited about that I was seen with them, and so today I was hailed into court, and a judge asked me where the lad had gone. I replied that since he was a friend of mine, I could not betray him. Then the court waxed wroth, and the judge talked a great deal about my duty to the state and society and other things I did not understand, and bade me tell where my friend had flown. By this time, I was becoming wrathful myself, for I had explained my position. But I choked my ire and held my peace, and the judge squalled that I had shown contempt for the court, and that I should be hurled into a dungeon to rot until I betrayed my friend. So then, seeing that they were all mad, I drew my sword and cleft the judge's skull. Then I cut my way out of the court, and seeing the high constable's stallion tied nearby, I rode for the wharfs where I thought to find a ship bound for foreign parts. I mean, this is basically what happened in the last issue, but we see here that Conan has got a definite code. He was held in contempt of court because he wouldn't rat out his friends, and he's not about to do that. And when he finds that, okay, they're going to throw me into the dungeon to rot until I die, until I, betray my friends, well, the heck with that. I'm just going to, you know, get out of here. So he, takes them down. And that pretty much happened there. Recounted to the ship captain here. And there they go. So that takes up a little bit of the initial part of this thing. And then they're sailing down the coast, and we see some scenes where we get a little bit of an idea of what the Hyborian world is like. We go by the coast of Shem, where bearded horsemen sit on their steeds along the shore and eye the ship with suspicion. There's scant profit to trade with the fierce and wary sons of Shem. We go by Stygia and the river Styx. We find that the serpent worshippers are there. There's a lot of sorcerers. We don't want to go there. We pass another place that has some siren-type voluptuous women drawn very beautifully by John Buscema, posing and posturing brazenly. We assume they're going to try to lure the sailors in, and they have none of that. And then they move down the coast towards Kush, which is of in the Hyborian world, this is essentially an analog to Africa. And the ship is going to be trading, and they're going to be trading for ivory and such with the black people down there, and then take that trade back up. And that's basically, this is a merchant vessel. They trade various things to the natives down in Kush, and then they bring what they get from them, furs and pelts and what gold and whatnot, and they bring that back up. And that's how they make their money. And it turns out that as they get to the town, the village that they were going to be trading with, everyone's been slaughtered. And there we get the, they've been attacked, and maybe Bailey's Tigris has been here. And then as we move along, sure enough, there is the pirate ship. It's Bailey. We had better watch out for ourselves because this is bad news. And they try to row. Volleys of arrows come across from the other ship. They take out various people. The ship pulls up. Bailey and her black warriors come on and they rampage across the ship. Of course, Conan fiercely fights his way to the deck, kills a whole bunch of these guys, and Bailey is suitably impressed. She observes that he's no soft Hyborian, and she is intrigued by him. And if he can beat her strongest warrior, then good things will happen. And we'll see how good those things are in a moment. So here we have this large fellow named Odongo who Conan has to fight, and a mighty battle comes along. Conan manages to heave this guy into the water, which apparently is shark infested, and he gets chomped down by the sharks. And Bailey, of course, offers herself to Conan. Take me, Conan, take me and crush me with your fierce love. Go with me to the ends of the earth and the ends of the sea. I am a queen by fire and steel and slaughter. Be thou my king. And Conan, no fool, takes her up on this offer because she is gorgeous. And why fight this ship full of people and get either killed and tossed into the sea, or else you're going to be the only guy left alive standing on this ship, and it's kind of hard to sail a big ship by yourself. So he takes her up on the offer. She does the very sexy mating dance of Bailey, and then off they go into a private interlude. And that was the end of the issue. And this sets up the introduction to Bailey and Conan as her first mate and lover. We're on our way through another 40 some odd issues and 3.5 years of Conan and Bailey stories.
Well, I will say, when they do decide to transition the status quo, I mean, they do a fairly solid job of doing that and not just, hey, it's suddenly different, which I respect. So that takes us into the next issue, which is the Ballad of Bailey. I mean, basically, it's been a couple of months, and we meet them, you know, as they're attacking another ship. And, you know, Conan's, of course, you know, fighting and stuff, doing pretty well. But, you know, also very impressed with how well his new captain and queen is doing. They come across a Stygian priest, and who basically curses them, which is like, geez, what do you expect a priest to do, I guess? They don't take too well to that, so they sink the ship, which, again, they have a habit of doing. Bailey's like, hey, you know, come join me in my cabin in a little bit, and we'll go take care of some more business or whatever. So while he's waiting for her to clean up from the battle, he asks the shaman, you know, what's her story? What is her background? And, of course, we then go into flashback and start to get that.
So I will point out that, I mean, I can see how some of this can be sort of off-putting because, you know, these guys are kind of sociopaths if you put them into the, you know, modern context. I mean, they're pirates who are like rampaging the high seas, just, you know, robbing and slaughtering everybody that they come upon. So, it's a little hard to identify with them in these two stories. There's no like actual authorities back then. So.
Well, the Blade. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's also just a very different kind of a story because now, again, we're doing the pirate thing on ships, whereas before it was all land-based. It's got a different feel to it. It's still fun action-adventure, but, you know, it could have easily just been a separate, you know, thing entirely at this point. You know, if this were a modern comic, it'd be an all-new number one with a six-issue story arc going into, you know, how he gets on the ship. So we get her background story and how she was the king's daughter, but her uncle was kind of a, you know, wanting to be the king, so he has his brother killed or what have you. She gets rescued by the shaman, gets her out of there because the shaman realizes she stays, she's dead. They wind up over in one of the Stygian ports and I was there, whatever. Anyways, basically the shaman takes her to his native place, who, of course, you know, he's been away from there for a while, so they've kind of forgotten about him. He throws the magic fire powder out and, you know, impresses them with the magic. They're like, ooh, we should listen. And he's like, you know, I'm your shaman or whatever. She's your goddess, and kind of sets her up to raise her there. She gets trained in, you know, how to go kill, you know, leopards and, you know, how to use a bow and how to fight baboons and, you know, other useful life skills.
Hey, that was a mean baboon. It was a man-eating baboon as it was turned.
That's true, but she's not a man. She's a woman, so, you know, hey.
True. She had an advantage.
Yeah. And we get some of this in, you know, quick, I'm blanking on the word, you know what I mean, though, for that panel on the bottom of 142.
Montage.
Quick montage, thank you. And then it gets to where it's time for the rite of passage for some of the other guys in the tribe. She's like, hey, I want to do this too. And she's like, you're a woman. But she basically, you know, forces the way in, and the chieftain says, fine, very well. Bring back the silver eye of Dagon, and, you know, we shall declare you a warrior. And she's like, well, okay, but the shaman's like, you know, hey, this is impossible. You can't do this. Well, the chieftain's like, well, you know, I am the chieftain. I can do this. So she heads off to go do that, and the shaman's like, you know, hey, be careful, you know, all that kind of stuff, and passes her a vial of a liquid silver. She goes into the big cave where this thing is.
He's all these weird worm people. I didn't care for this part of the story.
The mound
weird
dwellers.
Big worm guys, you know, fondling this silver gem was kind of weird.
Yeah, and the impression is they can sense silver, and that's what they're drawn to. So she grabs the eye, but didn't have time to replace it with the vial of silver, and she gets followed out by these mound dwellers, heads back to the village. At which point she realizes that the chieftain has set up the shaman saying, you know, hey, he's, you know, made the gods unhappy. The sun's being blotted out, in which the chieftain or the shaman realizes, oh, yeah, the chieftain knew about the eclipse this afternoon. Belit comes plowing in saying, hey, I've got the eye of Dagon. The chieftain's like, see, she does this and still brings, you know, disaster upon us. She's evil, whatever. Shaman brings out some magic, doing the whole hands burst into flames thing, which is kind of cool. Belit goes after the chieftain. She's about to gut him. The shaman's like, no, stop. Think about it for a second. There's a better way. She stops. She thinks. She pours the stuff from the vial down his throat. That's the liquid silver, which, of course, is what the mound dwellers are after. They go after. They take the chieftain, and suddenly the village is in need of new leadership. The shaman's like, you know, The chieftain had proclaimed her a goddess, you know, a true daughter of, you know, whatever god. So the village says, oh, yeah, she's our new chieftain. And that's how she gets her power base. And that was apparently 3 years back from when the flashback is. And, you know, Conan's like, well, you know, is this really true or not? How much is this embellishment? He heads down to the cabin. And as she's putting some pearls and rubies and stuff away, he sees the eye of Dagon, which, of course, is for us to believe, oh, yeah, it is true. And that's pretty much where the issue ends.
So, I chose to believe that the big, weird worm people were an embellishment of the shaman story, so I didn't have to deal with that as a reality in the context of the series.
But it's a good origin for her, and since particularly she was going to be around for a couple of years, a smart move to do that early on. You know, she got a good solid introduction in the previous issue, and now we get her backstory and, you know, establish her as a worthy companion for Conan. So that's where the trade ends. It was good read. I enjoyed the afterword by Roy Thomas, where he was kind of, you know, explaining a couple of the decisions he made, like you were talking about earlier with Yusuf and Tara, you know, filling in for one of the established parts of the Conan mythology, which was really kind of a, I don't want to say a throwaway line, but it was a nice way for him to tie stuff in. And that was also one of the things he did in All-Star Squadron that I really enjoyed, is he was working within the confines of some established continuity and really fleshing things out and filling in the gaps. And I could see where that really played to his strengths on Conan. So overall, I liked it. I liked the parts with Tara a little bit better, but I didn't dislike any of it. The fill-in story, it was a fill-in story. That was actually probably the weakest part of the trade. Based on this, I could definitely see reading more Conan, but don't feel the need to go seek it out and that I must read more Conan. I can totally understand the appeal of the property, though. And it's actually a little surprising that we're not seeing it stronger these days than it seems to be. You know, it seems like a timeless
competition
property.
You know, I think, you know, back then, there were so many fewer comic books. This really stood out as unique and different. You know, I don't remember how many, but certainly Marvel and DC each might have put out maybe 15, 20 titles, something like that.
Maybe as much as 30 or 40, but that was it, top. So a fraction of what they've got now, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just there weren't that many titles. And the independent market was pretty much non-existent in the 70s. You know, you had Archie's and Harvey's and things like that. But this was very different. I mean, if you wanted this kind of a story, this was the place to get it.
The only thing I could think of that would be even remotely close to it, although fairly different, would be the Warlord series over at DC.
And I don't know that had actually started up by the, you know, when did that start? I mean, it might have been starting up about by the time they got this far up in Conan, but certainly there was a period where, you know, there certainly was not any Conan.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, any competition to Conan.
Pulling up Comic Book DB now to see when Warlord started. And
it was first in, like, first issue special number 8, maybe?
It started in 76 for the ongoing series. So I figured first issue special was prior to that. So, yeah, around. And these issues.
So right around this time.
Yeah, right around this time. Which, I mean, you know, you're over at DC. You see that Marvel's got this licensed property doing pretty well. What are you going to do? You're going to, you know, try to do something similar to it. Makes sense.
Yep. But, I mean, there it is. I mean, I certainly think that it's worth giving a read. At $17... You know, I would maybe recommend going to in-stock trades and, you know, getting it at 35% off, or, you know, wait until your local shop's having a sale on trades. You know, $17 for 8 issues is a little steep. I mean, you're talking a little over $2 an issue for, you know, a reprint. I mean, it's good stuff, but it's a lot nicer if you're paying, you know, $11 or $12 for it.
Oh, yeah. Certainly cheaper is better, but I felt that I got a significant amount of story here, a lot more than I get in, you know, 8 modern issues.
Yeah.
So I would put this as a better deal than, you know, an equivalent, you know, modern 8 issue series in most cases.
True.
But I would agree. It's definitely worth checking out. I felt this was a good jumping on point. It's kind of unfortunate that the way the trade series broke between volumes, in so much as I think if they had had the last 2 issues of this as the start of a trade, it would have been a better jumping on point for the Baylete storyline.
Yeah, I agree, and it seems like it's just how they happened to you know, to roll,
yeah,
as it were. You know, it just, they didn't want to do a trade that had only 6 issues in it. But, you know, it is what it is. Actually, it's actually better that they didn't start with these two issues, because I would have picked that trade as what to get you into it, and you might not have liked it as much.
I would actually probably agree with that. I'm glad I started where I did. Yeah, but again, part of it is the Tara character I thought was interesting. I thought that opening storyline was good, because it had kind of like a feel of like the Mummy movies.
Right.
You know.
And that being said, I'll have to go ahead and take a look at Volume 9, see what the stuff is going on there, because it actually, I know what your tastes are to some extent, and as the other issues with Baelit start rolling, it might be more in your wheelhouse than these two introductory issues here. So
yeah. Oh, definitely. I'm open to doing more of this. It's, again, not something I feel, ooh, I've definitely got to, and I've got tons of other things fighting for my time to be read, but this was not painful to read by any stretch of the imagination. It was definitely worth reading.
Okay.
And if anyone has suggestions for future back issue spotlights, we do have the thread on the forum. So
yeah, and upcoming things that we're going to try to do a Star Wars episode. We're thinking of talking about the Force Unleashed graphic novel, and then just having a general conversation about Star Wars comics being put out by Dark Horse. Green Arrow and the Longbow Hunters is on our agenda. What else do we have queued up?
We've talked about doing Frey, the 8-issue miniseries in the Buffyverse with the future Slayer. What else have we talked about? We've talked about a few other things. We've talked about doing Dial H for Hero, but we're undecided on that since it's not collected, and therefore people wouldn't be able to go get it if they like it. So we'd like some feedback on, you know, is that a big deal or not? And there's one or two other things we were talking about, and I forget what they were.
I'm thinking it's like Queen and Country would actually be a good... You have the Queen and Country.
I've got the definitives, and I haven't read any of that. So I've got the first two volumes, and...
You know, probably don't want to go through an entire definitive, but in the first definitive, there are several storylines in there, you know, because the entire thing is...
Oh, it's huge. That's too much for one.
It's really huge, but... You know, you could easily do like Operation Broken Ground, which is the very first one, maybe even the first two. Broken Ground and Morningstar. Well, that's still 200 pages, you know. Actually, Broken Ground goes about 120 pages. That might be a good one to do. But Queen and Country's be fun to get in, you know, doing an indie one.
That would be good. Because, again, we want to try to vary between Marvel, DC, and other. And I like Greg Rucka, and it's one I've heard good things about, which is why I've picked up the definitive editions. And certainly doing a 120-page chunk of it sounds a lot more doable. So we'll put that on the list as a possibility.
And, you know, again, you know, visit the forums and put down other ideas. And we can certainly revisit Conan in the future. You know, we can either do some more Baelit if that's of interest to people, or we could jump forward, perhaps, and do the stories after Roy Thomas was off. You could do a compare and contrast on how some other creators take the handle on Conan.
And also let us know what you think of the format we tried here with doing a little bit of a spoiler-free discussion followed by the usual spoiler-filled discussion. Let us know what you think about that idea, if it's worth continuing with or not.
Okay.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.